It's Friday, October 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hi, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, China allows all of its citizens to have two children. Republican presidential hopefuls debate, we debate who won and lost.
Just getting back to that pinnacle and reestablishing yourself as a marquee franchise is huge.
Coming up, the amazing Mets on the baseball field and on the balance sheet. Singer Gloria Estefan hits the big screen. It's all on today's International Edition. After 35 years of limiting most couples to having just one child, China's Communist Party on Thursday announced it will change existing laws to allow all families to have two children without penalty. The policy was highly controversial, and despite its repeal, the one-child policy will still have a lasting impact on Chinese society. Two experts, Cheng Li, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution here in Washington, and Dudley Poston, professor of sociology at Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas, join us to discuss the former one-child policy. Dr. Li, the Asia Development Bank had estimated China's population would, by the year 2050, be comprised of 23% of its people over the age of 65. That compares to Indonesia at 18% and India at 14%, and this put China in quite a social dilemma.
Absolutely, and also by that time, really one person takes care of six elderly. This is a very, very awkward system. Without the social network, it will be a disaster.
You know, the other issue is this large, large number of bachelors that have already been born. I've estimated they've already been born 41 million boys who will not be able to find girls to marry. It's going to be even more difficult when those boys become adults and when their parents are then aging. So this is another issue, not just the single child, but the single child. Many of them are going to be men without wives.
It has almost become unintended birth control, hasn't it?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Dr. Poston, I know you've done some research on the subject. Even without the one-child policy, there are and will remain an awful lot of bachelors in China.
One big problem, we've done some statistical simulation of contracting HIV/AIDS. There's several demographers and mathematicians have looked at this issue and have projected that in the next 10 or 15 years, there could be a HIV epidemic in China that could rival that of sub-Saharan Africa. Another implication could be if you're going to have 30, 40 million boys, men, who don't have wives, and they're all within about a 10 to 20 year age group, what's the country going to do with them? Will the country then revert back to more of an authoritarian regime? Will the country use those boys to help fight international battles? All kinds of interesting implications that we haven't really even begun to see, let alone think about.
Well, I'm less concerned about that. I think maybe this is a little bit too sensational. Of course, that we do not have too much reliable evidence, but we do know that the racial imbalance start to reduce or decline in the past few years. I think that with many factors and also with the market adjustment, actually, I would think that people will change their views about boys and girls. But I think there's another dimension we haven't discussed, is the little emperor phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
You know, this kind of very spoiled child when you become adult. These people may have difficulties to be sociable or to work together with others. And this is a phenomenon deserves much more attention, in my view, and because this is unique in human history.
I was just going to comment that we've done a lot of research here in Texas of 4,000 children in China over the past 10 or 15 years. And surprising, what we find is that, correct, there are a lot of little emperors, but there are proportionally a similar good number of what we would call good kids. The Chinese call them little dragons. In other words, proportionally, there are as many little emperors as little dragons in China as we see in the West. The one-child policy, the evidence is pretty clear, did not result in entirely all the single children being little emperors.
Well, our thanks to you, Dudley Poston, professor of sociology at Texas A&M University, and to Cheng Li, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Well, in U.S. politics, Republican Paul Ryan has been elected as Speaker of the House, but the election today was largely a formality after the House Republicans nominated him for the position yesterday. And to tell us what people are saying online about the decision, our social media correspondent G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio. Welcome, G.
Hi, Jim. Twitter highlighted Democrats' reaction to Ryan's new position as a House Speaker Thursday. The top trending hashtag related to the news is hashtag Ryan Reality Check. So let's begin with a tweet from Meredith Kelly, who is a National Press Secretary for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, or DCCC. She tweeted this. In a 17-paragraph speech, Speaker Ryan spent three paragraphs making concessions to the House Freedom Caucus, also known as the neglected minority. Hashtag Ryan Reality Check. She's also actively retweeting from the DCCC account.
I see. So what's that account tweeting?
Well, not surprisingly, a lot of memes about Ryan's budget plans. Jim, memes are definitely more eye-catching than just regular tweets. And at first glance, it seems like DCCC is quite savvy and prolific on Twitter. Its handle is, of course, at DCCC.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. So many of the memes show what Ryan said and what the relevant quote-unquote facts are side by side in one meme. And here's an example. Speaker Ryan, we will not duck tough issues. Fact, Ryan said he would abandon efforts to pass comprehensive immigration reform. Here's another one. Ryan, no more favors for the few. Fact, millionaires would likely get a $245,000 tax cut under the Ryan budget.
And some great pictures there, too. You're just going to have to go to Twitter and look these up. What about from outside of the political circle?
Liz Winstead, who is the co-creator of The Daily Show and quite influential on Twitter, shared a link to a New York Times editorial from 3 years ago and tweeted this. Hashtag TBT, that means Throwback Thursday, of course. Paul Ryan is a person who will bring people together in emergency rooms and at local food banks. About 150 people marked it as a favorite, and I just want to add that the editorial is by the American economist Paul Krugman. Jim?
Always great for your updates and a lot of fun they're having with Paul Ryan. G. Abby Lee is our social media guru. She tweets from our program's account at VOA_IE. You, of course, can follow her on her own account as well, at G. Abby Lee. I'm on Twitter, at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, we just considered the new Republican Speaker of the House and the leading Republican presidential candidates held their third debate on Wednesday in Boulder, Colorado. As promised on yesterday's show, VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone is back with us in the studio now to assess what happened. Jim, it seems that the candidates didn't turn on each other as much as they did on the media.
That was a big theme of the night. And, you know, we've seen it before in Republican presidential politics. It took me back 3 years ago to Newt Gingrich when he turned a question on the debate moderator at the time about his personal life and the audience erupted. And we had that moment with Ted Cruz complaining that it was all about gotcha politics and that the moderators and the questioners didn't really want to get into the substantive issues of the day. And in fact, at one point, Mike Huckabee was invited to go after Donald Trump, one of the moderators said, is he the moral authority worthy of being president? So we saw quite a bit of pushback, but we also saw the candidates at times going after each other. And I think the more we see these debates, that's going to have to be a feature because, look, it is a competition at the end of the day. The candidates need to show some separation from one another.
Right. And that's really the only way to define the candidates is to point out the differences and where they stand on the issues. Who do you feel really shined in this debate?
Well, it looks as though from all the commentary and some of the reception by conservatives that Florida Senator Marco Rubio did pretty well. He was forceful not only in defending his own record against some of his rivals, but in going after the leading Democrat, Hillary Clinton, a few times. Rubio in particular was at a spotlight moment when his political mentor, Jeb Bush, the former Florida governor, turned to him and challenged him about his voting record in the Senate since he's been running for president. And Rubio has acknowledged missing votes, but he says other presidential candidates in the past who were senators have done the same thing, and Jeb Bush did not call them out. A lot of the commentary has been very critical of Jeb Bush.
And a bit of a surprise, I guess, for the Bush camp because, and we've had this discussion privately, that, you know, he seemed to appear to be kind of the real deal of the Bush family compared at least to his brother.
Yeah, he has a record that a lot of conservatives admire as a two-term governor of Florida in terms of the budget, in terms of taxes, economic growth. He has some things to boast about. He's been very critical of the Obama administration's foreign policy coming in. And this confrontation in this latest debate between Bush and Rubio is significant. It almost seemed to some as though there was a passing of the torch here, that a new generation of aggressive, young, dynamic conservatives is coming up and challenging the old order, symbolized by people like Jeb Bush.
As for Donald Trump and Ben Carson, do they come out unscathed at least?
I don't know. I'd be interested to see how the polls rate them in the next week or so following the debate. I mean, Trump had his moments, but he certainly wasn't the dominant force we've seen before. And, you know, what can you say about Ben Carson? He was Ben Carson, which kind of a mystery figure. He definitely was clear about not wanting to attack his rivals and at the end of the day delivered the kind of low-key demeanor that voters, particularly in Iowa, seem to like right now.
Well, no mystery figure here. Senior political correspondent Jim Malone knows what he's talking about. Thanks for stopping by, Jim.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
On March 12, 2009, Bernie Madoff pleaded guilty to 11 U.S. federal felonies and admitted to turning his wealth management business into a massive Ponzi scheme. The Madoff investment scandal defrauded billions of dollars from thousands of investors, including Major League Baseball's New York Mets. We're joined by Thomas Barabi, a reporter for International Business Times. Tom, how did the Mets get mixed up in this?
Essentially, the Mets owners invested pretty heavily in the Madoff scheme before anyone really knew the extent of it. So when that fell apart, they lost a lot of money. They lost hundreds of millions of dollars. And you know, Mets fans are, and really any New York sports fan is used to having the kind of big marketability payroll-wise, signing big players, getting a lot of big contracts. Essentially, that Madoff incident and kind of the fallout from that, and it kind of crippled the team's ability to spend money for a while. That, coupled with the construction of their new stadium, which created a lot of debt. So for a team that had usually spent, you know, in the top five in Major League Baseball to get the best players out there, suddenly they're looking at a payroll that was more in the middle, and they lost a lot of their ability that, you know, they relied on to compete.
Now, of course, we're talking about one of the biggest major markets in New York, and, of course, the Mets have tons of fans. So would the Mets really have a financial problem for that long because of this?
The mid-2000s, when they were last competitive, or, you know, really competitive, payroll was top five. Back then it was a little bit lower just because of, you know, the way the market worked in baseball. But depending on what account you wanted to follow, they were hundreds of millions of dollars in debt. Between, you know, again, the stadium bond debt and the Madoff scandal. So coming into this season, they've been relying on kind of an austere approach to building their roster. Before they got back to the World Series this year, they had six consecutive seasons just as they tried to bring along their younger players and rely on kind of cheap veterans to fill the gap.
Well, an austere roster doesn't necessarily make a World Series team, so I'm sure Mets fans are quite pleased that they have reached the big show here.
Yeah, I think it's a testament to the general manager, Sandy Alderson. He's made the most of what he's had to work with. They've brought along some great young pitching, Matt Harvey, Jacob DeGrom, and they've relied on some key veteran bats, David Wright, Yoenis Cespedes, to kind of carry the load. And everything just happened to brick right for them this year. They had a huge second half, and things are not going so well so far in the World Series, but it's still got a few games to go, and hopefully they can turn it around.
The Fall Classic certainly should help their bottom line out.
Yeah, it's going to be a huge help for them. They actually, coming into the season, just based on their payroll and what they expected from ticket sales, they thought they were going to lose about $10 million. And this playoff run, this World Series run, which was kind of a surprise to everyone in baseball and in New York, has kind of completely flipped that script. They're now looking at a $45 million windfall in the form of advanced ticket sales for next season, as well as the home games throughout the playoffs and through the World Series. So it's kind of set them up for a strong future in the sense that now they're back in the black, they're making money again. And in theory, if the ownership is behind it, they can start putting that money back into the team, back into the payroll, and get back to what New York fans are used to.
Well, I know on the field they'd like to make a comeback and certainly win another World Series, because it's been a while for New York Mets fans, but it seems at least by getting to the Fall Classic, they have won financially.
Oh, for sure. You know, it's one of those things where, of course, you would like to win. You know, it's been a long drought for Mets fans, but in terms of drawing sponsors, drawing more season ticket holders, just getting back to that pinnacle and reestablishing yourself as a marquee franchise is huge. And they should see the windfall from that either way, regardless of whether or not they win.
Well, Tom Barabi, he's a reporter for the International Business Times, and we're thrilled to have you with us today.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
The Mets currently trail the Kansas City Royals 2-0 in the best-of-seven games World Series. By the way, Kansas City last won it in 1985, the Mets in 1986. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
A new musical based on the lives and music of Gloria and Emilio Estefan opened in New York on November 5th. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, On Your Feet looks at the groundbreaking Grammy-winning couple who gave the world hits such as Conga, 1-2-3, and Get On Your Feet.
Ana Villafañe is a lifelong fan of Gloria Estefan. She even attended the same Miami, Florida high school as the seven-time Grammy-winning singer, Our Lady of Lourdes Academy. Now she gets to work with and to portray the star in the new musical, On Your Feet. Villafañe learned of a Miami Open casting call last year, but was not able to attend. She sent the casting office a video audition, and within 3 days was called to audition for the Estefans and Tony-winning director Jerry Mitchell. Ana says that the role, her Broadway debut, is not only the fulfillment of a dream, but also a big responsibility.
I mean, to be chosen to play this part and to step into these shoes, it's a huge deal, you know, because she's not just who she is, and it's not because she's a star, and it's not because she's such a diva, which she rightfully is. It's more because I think of the person that she is and what she represents to so many people, to not just the Latin community, I think on the world stage, because she broke a lot of barriers in being herself and in being herself without being a stereotype and without being cliche.
The musical also stars Josh Segarra as Emilio Estefan. Segarra says that he has seen the cultural barriers shift in theater, where Latin actors and actresses are not defined by their ethnicity and don't have to fit into stereotypical roles.
We now get to play characters that happened to be Latino. Mm-hmm. They happened to be Cuban and happened to be El Salvadorian and happened to be Puerto Rican. And it's not defining us anymore. So to get to play a man that has broken walls, that's broken barriers, that's an honor. You know, I get to kind of live through that a little bit. I get to say some pretty important stuff in this show. We get to share some pretty important moments in this show. And we get to live it every night. So as an artist, you can only grow from that.
Ana Villafañe says the play shows some of the struggles the Estefans went through to stay true to their identity and to their vision.
You know, she tells me stories all the time about when she would get somewhere and, you know, certain concert venues would be like, oh, we want to put, like, you know, fruits on your head and, like, you know, red lipstick and this and that and just the what you would stereotypically think. And she would say, no, I'm going out in leather and I'm going out in chaps and she kind of, you know, she didn't have to be any certain mold. She created one.
On Your Feet features choreography by four-time Drama Desk Award nominee and Olivier Award winner Sergio Trujillo. The book is by Academy Award winner Alexander Dinilaris. The score includes original orchestrations by Gloria and Emilio Estefan, and several members of the original Miami Sound Machine are in the orchestra. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Time for us to get up on our feet and move on out of the studio, at least for a little while. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. We're also on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Zainab Abdel-Rahman. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the face of the growing horrors of the Syrian conflict that has led so far to the deaths of more than 250,000 people, the displacement of millions, and the rise of the terrorist group Daesh, a fresh effort is being made toward finding a political solution to the crisis. On October 23rd, Secretary of State John Kerry met in Vienna with counterparts from Russia, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. After the meeting, Secretary Kerry said all had arrived with a commitment to try to find new ideas on how to break the impasse and end the Syrian conflict. They agreed, he said, that the effort be based on the principles of the 2012 Geneva Communique, which, among other measures, calls for a political transition in Syria. Secretary Kerry described such a transition as one that will stop the killing and lay the groundwork for a government that the Syrian people deserve and support and can arrive at with their input. It is ultimately about how we can get to the table where the Syrians themselves are deciding the future of Syria. Secretary of State Kerry emphasized that a political transition in Syria requires an international approach and noted that the ministers agreed to the aim of reconvening and to broaden discussion with a wider range of interested parties. With this in mind, the United States, represented by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken, participated in a Paris meeting about Syria on October 27th, hosted by the French government, with representatives from Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Jordan, Qatar, Turkey, Germany, the United States, Italy, and Britain. Now Secretary of State Kerry has arrived in Vienna for a series of bilateral and multilateral discussions about Syria on October 29th and 30th. All concerned governments have a responsibility to contribute to ending the Syrian conflict through a transition that will unite the country and enable it to live in peace. That is the goal sought by the United States of America, said Secretary of State Kerry. That is the purpose of the inclusive diplomatic process that we are pursuing. And that is the urgent wish of the vast majority of the Syrian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.